Welcome to the AANEM podcast series, a monthly discourse on recent publications in neuromuscular and electrodiagnostic literature, featuring interviews with the authors and other experts, brought to you by the American Association of Neuromuscular and Electrodiagnostic Medicine. The AANEM welcomes your comments, suggestions, and questions. Email them to aanem@aanem.org.
Hello, my name is Andy Galbraith from Sentara Health in Virginia Beach. Thank you all for tuning in and welcome to the AANEM podcast. Today, I have the pleasure of talking with Dr. Mohammed Taha at Massachusetts General, as well as Dr. John Morin at the Neuromuscular Center at Cleveland Clinic's Neurological Institute. And this is about their recent article published in Muscle and Nerve called The Role of Artificial Intelligence and Electrodiagnostic and Neuromuscular Medicine, Current State and Future Directions. Doctors Taha and Morin, thank you both for this outstanding review article, and also thanks for your time today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
This is an issue for many of us, myself included, that can be accompanied by some degree of angst, uncertainty, uneasiness are some words that come up, but also obviously great excitement. The topic is, of course, artificial intelligence and specifically the applications in our field, electrodiagnostic and neuromuscular medicine. Dr. Morin, you gave a talk last year at AANEM. I was there. It was very hands-on. We had our laptops open. You walked us through downloading ChatGPT and so on. By the way, that room was packed. There was people on the floor, sitting on the floor. They were standing around the side. So obviously, it's a hot topic. And this was 2023. It seems so new. But AI is not actually a new thing, right?
Oh, quite correct, Andy. It's interesting to see how far back it goes. In the 1940s, 1950s, McCulloch and Pitts started to work on the artificial neuron. And of course, I could go off on explaining why as neurologists, neuroscientists, and even physiatrists who work so intimately with the neuromuscular system, why we should own this. They were working on this artificial neuron way back then. A few years later, Rosenblatt in the 1950s, 60s, developed what he called the perceptron, which is essentially the unit of an artificial neural network, which we'll talk about. There were these very exciting innovations happening then, and there was a fair amount of buzz about AI that kind of petered off because there was few very important rate-limiting steps that kept back this from exploding the way it has in the last few years. And I might add that what has kind of contributed to this more recent AI explosion, two things that kind of came to the forefront. One was increased computing power, especially with the development of what's called graphics processing units or GPUs. That allows for really remarkable what's called parallel computing and processing, and then the availability of big data. We are collecting enormous amounts of data, and they're part of repositories that can be accessed to leverage these technologies to be truly innovative. And of course, you know, since ChatGPT came on the scene back in November of 2022, I think the public consciousness towards AI really came to a peak. I mean, we had 2 billion, that's a B as in boy, 2 billion website visitors for the ChatGPT website by May of 2023. So kind of speaking to the fact that there is remarkable public interest in this, and this will spill over obviously into multiple fields, and a huge one being medicine and neuromuscular and electrodiagnostic medicine in particular.
Can one of you tell us maybe some of the things, if we're nervous about AI, some of the uses that are in existence now?
Yeah, actually, there is a great use of AI in our daily lives. This ranges from using AI in our smartphones like Siri and Alexa. Those are AI models that help us navigate through our daily lives, up to recommendation algorithms in Netflix, Amazon, and other websites that help you tailor down what you need. So these basically are based on AI models that takes data from the user and try to tailor down the product based on your own preferences. Also, email spams, kind of a type of rudimentary AI algorithms that kind of automatically detect emails, unwanted emails, and so on and so forth. Also, language translation applications that uses text or speech to generate text in other language. That's also some form of AI. And Google itself, all of us have been using Google search. And It's one of the early on algorithms that help in searching the internet. So we have been using, as you said, AI in form of or the other in our daily basis.
The article starts with things we've discussed already, then gets into some of the technical aspects. And I was hoping that one of you guys could just talk a little bit about that. There are terms that pop up like machine learning, deep learning, talked a little bit. We mentioned these artificial neural networks. Can one of you guys or both speak to some of that?
I'll take a stab at this one. The term artificial intelligence or AI can be explained or defined in multiple ways. One way is regarding computer systems that possess the intellectual processes very characteristic of humans, including the ability to reason, discover meaning, generalize, and learn from past experience. Again, there's a lovely analogy to things that we know in neuroscience and even in education learning theory. For example, some of the traditional learning theories that talk about cognitivism, where basically the brain is like a hard drive, and if you can file away things very efficiently by using appropriate sequencing and ordering, you'll have more efficient storage and retrieval, etc. But more modern learning theories like constructivism really emphasizes making meaning out of experience and that learning process being augmented, reinforced, or enhanced with repetition. And certainly these models, they are training using a very iterative process and self-improvement with repetition. So you get better and better with repetition. So, you know, we borrow from some of those learning theories like constructivism. You might even say experiential learning, and another modern learning theory called connectivism are all that can draw parallels with what's happening with machine learning. People ask, you know, so what's the difference between some of the things that we saw before, like automation, you know, like when let's say nerve conduction studies, when machines drop markers where they think that the takeoff is in a waveform, for example. You know, we had those little tools and tricks built into machinery before. So a lot of the computing that went with simple automations were based on the traditional rubric of rules-based systems or situation action rules, where the engineers had to anticipate every particular scenario possible, which is impossible to do, and program that into the application. So it would basically work off the if this, then that kind of principle. But obviously, that has certain limitations. The awesome thing about the evolution in computing that came about with machine learning is that there's no need for explicit programming of if this, then that rules. Basically, what we are seeing is the computer is able to look at inputs and match them to outputs. Simple example would be if we show the computer system a picture of a cat versus a picture of a dog, and we give it appropriate labels. So we say this is a cat, has these features, and you know, we match that to the output. This image equal cat, and then we say this image equal dog, and you do that for an enormous amount of different repetitions. The machine gets it, and then you could bring a picture it never saw before of a cat, and it'll be right. So that's what machine learning is. Now you can see it still involves some handcraft, and you gotta in this pre-processing, you have to create these labels and feed it into the training algorithm. So it's a fairly manual process, but the learning is autonomous. After a while, the machine is going to be really good at classifying, like putting things in these discrete categories. And that's machine learning. So what is deep learning then? So deep learning is actually this at another awesome level. Basically, we don't need to kind of handcraft or manually label data. We basically feed data that's fairly not curated or undifferentiated into the model, and it figures out on its own, looking input versus output. There's a mathematical type of rendering that's done to figure out what's the appropriate output for the input that you provide to it. And what makes it deep learning is that the computer machinery is actually mimicking the human brain, the cortex in particular. So what that means, it's utilizing an artificial neural network. And again, as neuroscientists, we should embrace this because they're using the object of our regard and love, the nervous system, as the template for this. So we got skin in the game here. I mean, when you think about how nerves work, right? So we think of a neuron, a nerve cell, it has these multiple dendrites that are bringing input into the cell body or the soma. The cell body takes these summated weighted inputs, and there's the application of an activation function. And if a certain threshold is exceeded, then an output is generated, and that goes down the axon, right? So you get this binary output, and then that connects with other neurons. That's exactly what they're doing. And in our paper, figure three kind of spells this out. And if you basically connect multiple neurons, and again, these are artificial neurons, you'll get a layer. And then if you stack layers on top of each other, you get multiple layers. And when you say deep learning, what you're having is an artificial neural network that has multiple levels that get pretty deep. And then these layers also connect to synapses with each other. And just like the brain, these synapses also perform editing functioning. And you get this amazing potential to process complex data and execute complex functions at a high degree of accuracy, very reminiscent of what's happening in the human brain. You can tell there's a lot to this that's powerful, but you will hear words like black box functioning. And that's when basically we're using these models and they're producing results even better than what the engineers had anticipated, and they don't know exactly why. And then, you know, we try to demystify some of those black box functions by using something called explainability methods. And that teaches us a thing or two about how we can even do better with our AI. And we'll talk more about that in some examples.
Wow. So that's a lot and very helpful. I'm trying not to ask two basic questions here, but reading the article, I'm wondering with these deeper layers. So the inputs, these are all things that are still manually generated, or at some point it starts to pick up things, I guess, automatically. Is that right?
Yeah. Right. So, sorry, maybe I'll let Mohammed take this one.
Thank you. I will add to what Dr. Morin said. In a simplistic way, you can think about machine learning as statistical and mathematical equations. So for example, we all know about logistic regression. So you have, or linear regression. So you have a sample, a database with multiple samples, and you try to find the relationship. So you kind of like draw this line. And then in the future, when you predict, you will say, okay, if I have this X input, what will be the Y input? So this is basically what the linear regression look like. So machine learning is more sophisticated, but similar model that try to model the data, find the relationship between the data. And instead of having a one linear association, it will be more convoluted, more nonlinear. And then the deep learning is more sophisticated compared to that. When you have a large corpus of data and you are sure there is some form of probability association, meaning that these models are probabilistic and not deterministic, you feed those data and the model itself will try to find those relationships, will try to come up with a long equation to express the relationship between those data so that in the future, when you give a new data, let's say a new EMG, it can give you the class prediction. Let's say this is from a patient with ALS, for example. And this training process happens one time, but you can also update the model as you gain more and more information.
Okay, thank you. And so let's move on from that understanding of the technical aspects of machine learning and then deep learning to sort of the article topic, which is electrodiagnostic and neuromuscular medicine. And we can think about it very sort of clinically. So all of us are doing this. And so even yesterday, you know, I had somebody referred for cervical radiculopathy in the EMG lab with some degree of numbness in a hand and neck pain and shoulder pain. So we brought the person in and started with some nerve conduction studies. We've all done these, you know, very carefully measuring distances, controlling temperature, making sure the anatomy is correct, and then collecting data. And that process, any artificial intelligence there, or is that the old school stuff?
So actually, this is still where the human is needed. The robotic part of machine learning is still developing, where the actual robots can do the physical things. The machine learning currently is after you get all of the information ready, it helps with processing, meaning that interpreting and making sense of the information. For example, the nerve conduction studies, even the subtle things, the subtle changes in numbers that us as human do not pay attention to, if you have enough signal and enough data, the machine will be able to learn that. So it's mainly now focused on the data.
So if I thought down the road, like you said, the subtle things, we talk about waveform takeoffs, maybe anomalous innervation, things like that, maybe something that would flag and just have you look twice at it or something if you overlooked it quickly. Is that something?
Exactly. Yeah. So the more data you have, there are a lot of questions can be answered. Some of them could be screening for abnormal innervations, could be early detection of diseases that look like a borderline normal, or specific patterns of abnormalities that otherwise would not be obvious to us for detection. And if you had these kind of normal values for the population, and you fed also a lot of patients' values, the machine will be able to kind of tease them apart. And that can help with early detection in the future.
Great. And then naturally, we move on to EMG. And EMG is different because it involves a motor unit analysis in real time in a time domain in general. And there's a lot of different parameters that go into creating that EMG signal. There's a lot of automated parameters, right? So the raw EMG signal is an aspect you guys discuss in the paper. And then also the later AI processing of some of that. Would you mind explaining a little bit of that difference between the taking that raw EMG signal and then using some of the AI applications for it?
Yeah, definitely. I can take this one. Actually, we are very blessed with having to deal with EMG because it's very dense, heavily data-dense signals. So just as a background, the EMG is a measurement of voltage changes. And in 1 second, we could have up to 50,000 small measurements. So this is what we call by the sampling rate. It ranges from 10 kilohertz up to 50 kilohertz. There is a lot of information a 1 second of EMG has. And we are currently relying on human eye for this high dimensional meaning is very complex data. We're still relying on the human experience and expertise to make meaning out of those EMG signals. So those EMG signals are saved after filtered and brought to the attention of the human reader, and then the human reader would make sense of it. However, right now, machine learning models have been developed to actually look carefully at those highly dense signals and to make more associations than the one that we are able to do so. So we discuss in the paper a lot of examples that used different types of machine learning algorithms to make diagnosis of normal versus neuropathic versus myopathic classification. And the accuracy ranged from more than 60% up to more than 99%. So some of the algorithms actually did very well in categorizing those EMG signals. And this is just the early application for AI in EMG. And we anticipate a lot more performance in the future once we have enough and bigger amount of data.
That's the activation. There's also some applications for spontaneous activity. Is that right also?
Yeah, that's correct. Some of the papers use this high dense amount of signal and change it into a spectrogram, so kind of image of frequency over time, and fed that into an algorithm. And the algorithm in general was very capable of detecting different spontaneous activity abnormalities, such as fibrillations, fasciculations, and teasing them from, for example, noise artifacts. Of course, also it had some difficulties with differentiating myotonic discharges from CRDs and also fibrillation potentials from fasciculation. And this kind of similar to the training human also can have difficulty differentiating those abnormalities. Also, the recruitment analysis has been done. So not only the morphology of the units, but also how the subtlety in the recruitment can also be used for training for AI.
Yeah, that is interesting. And some of that is available now on the machines we have now, right? When you get into certain patterns of motor unit analysis. So are we using some AI right now for the motor unit recruitment analysis?
Some of it, yes. So some of it are the statistical machine learning algorithms, the older ones. Those have been developed for more than 3 to 4 decades. So yes, we use that. What is different about deep learning is it's more sophisticated and more capable. So we're going to expect more help, more assistance with those algorithms in grading your muscle, for example, helping grading the morphology and the recruitment, and also helping with EMG report generation. So those will be something to look for in the future.
Two other things I saw were the timing that might be a benefit to us in terms of maybe decreasing some of the time it may take to complete an EMG, and then also potentially patient comfort. I know there was some discussion in the paper of a surface EMG and an AI application there. Those are two things that I see as potential benefits to both patients and us. And of course, obviously, some of the diagnostic flags, the things we might miss otherwise. Is there anything else you think that we're looking for in future AI applications of for EMG?
I might add, you know, some of the critical conditions that suffer from diagnostic delay, let's say ALS, for example, where diagnostic delay has been shown in several studies to be an average over 1 year. And we also know that if we're going to develop drugs that are going to make a difference, that might be truly disease modifying, we need to get patients in earlier in their disease process, not at the end stage or burnout stage of their disease. Early diagnosis, several advantages. And if we could do that, that'll be a great service to our patients, no doubt. Well, how do we do it is always the difficult thing. I would imagine with the benefits that are coming from AI, especially being able to probably pick up on very signature changes for ALS, let's say using surface EMG, we might be looking at a future where there might be a point of care machine that can be in a general neurologist's office or even a primary care office that can screen for something like ALS if there are certain red flag symptoms, let's say, you know, painless foot drop and muscle twitching. That might be something that on the EMR of the family doc, it pops up. Hey, this patient needs screening. And maybe there is an ambulatory machine of that basically does a surface EMG, and it says high probability for motor neuron disease. Please refer to neuromuscular neurology or something like that. And these patients get they're saved from all the diagnostic delay hurdles along the way, and they get to the appropriate level of care for earlier diagnosis. So I see things like that being very, very useful benefits, that downstream benefits that come out of this technology.
That's a great point. And it also will bring up some ethical and some regulation issues too that we will talk about in just a little bit. But let's talk next about ultrasound. So, you know, in the past, I guess, 15, 20 years or so now, that's become more mainstream. And say this patient that came in for a radiculopathy screen, maybe it was negative and I was wondering about an entrapment neuropathy, I very well may do a ultrasound. And so I'm going to look for the anatomy, make sure I identify that appropriately. And then I want to measure those nerves that I'm going to look at. And so I want to measure them appropriately. And I want to make some sort of observation on the echogenicity of that nerve. And there's probably other things on that screen that I'm hoping I don't miss when I, you know, have that screenshot in front of me. Can you tell us where we are with AI and neuromuscular ultrasound right now?
Yes, and that's obviously another low-hanging fruit for AI, because images are rich with data as well. And for those who do ultrasound, you know that quite often, if you have a trainee or somebody looking over your shoulder and you're making the outline for that CSA, and they're like, wow, that's where I should draw the circle, huh? Because we do have the level of expertise and experience kind of guiding the accuracy of things like a CSA, cross-sectional area outline of a nerve. And that's a very important parameter, because those are the golden pieces of data that gets compared to some normative data for us to make a diagnosis. So, but it's subjective, unfortunately. And, you know, some of the more modern machines actually have on board some of that earlier AI technology that helps you determine what might be the appropriate CSA for the image that you're seeing in front of you. But with the deep learning applications, we're getting up to 98% diagnostic capture, which is awesome. And it's using these segmentation principles to get that. But you mentioned that CSA and kind of getting those two-dimensional metrics is one thing, but what about some of the qualitative things that come out of ultrasound, like echogenicity data? And indeed, when we look at another study of deep learning methods for neuromuscular ultrasound in carpal tunnel syndrome, we saw that the model was predicting with high accuracy, but not using cross-sectional area. And so that was kind of like a black box function. Wow, how's it doing that? So then we ran explainability. Again, this is an example of explainability, showing us something we could pay more attention to, because it was actually using the differential echogenicity of the nerve versus the surrounding tissue to make that determination. It was doing it at an accuracy rate of 96%. So again, it's helping us be less subjective. It's standardizing things and applying more rigor to diagnosis using ultrasound data.
What about muscle? So starting to use it a little bit more for muscle, is there an application of AI in muscle ultrasound?
Yeah, actually, studies have started using AI for measuring the contours of the muscle through different sections of the images and also calculating cross-sectional areas and echogenicity. And that tool can be used in the future as a follow-up or prognostication tool. For example, for patients with ALS, you can use that muscle echogenicity to follow them up over time and can give you some information about their muscle atrophy. Also, in muscle ultrasound, it has been used in video muscle ultrasound, so not only pictures, and specifically to detect muscle fasciculation. So this has been shown to be, to provide very high accuracy in detecting muscle fasciculations when compared to EMG, and that helped also in assessment of ALS and denervation as well. So both in measurement and also in detecting abnormalities, those AI algorithms have been kind of early on used in the muscle pathology field, and this can be built on in the future as well.
Yeah, I can see how that's very helpful diagnostically, but then also potentially, I guess, biomarker data in research studies. So that's great. There are some topics also discussed in this paper that are not specifically electrodiagnostic and neuromuscular ultrasound, but these are very relevant things that I read through the paper with things with diagnosis and prediction. Do you want to talk a little bit about those things?
Yeah, it's interesting to see how there are no limits really to where AI could be used. You know, somebody said it's like asking somebody, can you do with electricity? How do you start, right? This is a general purpose tool, much like electricity is. So almost anything that we do in our work as neuromuscular electrodiagnostic service providers that can be enhanced with AI. And we see it, for example, let's say prediction. You asked about that. There was a traditional machine learning model that predicted the admission to the ICU for MG patients, incipient or a full-blown crisis, getting an accuracy of 94%. That's pretty, pretty good. And again, the model taught us what was very important for that. It used the MGFA class and the presence of thymoma, for example, as heavy weighting into that predictive algorithm. And what I found was another interesting use was in the office. So by looking at facial expressions of our patients. So in myasthenics, they used a video recording of facial expressions, and they were able to get a diagnostic accuracy of 87%. And when it came to predicting the MG severity, it got up to 94%, which is pretty impressive. And that particular study actually compared it to four neurology experts, and their accuracy was 63%. So it kind of is, it shows, you know, what added diagnostic yield is brought about. And we'll talk about the threat to human experts, but, you know, it is very valuable. And when we're busy focusing on other things, and, you know, part of what AI could do is liberate us from planting our face into screens and liberating us from the keyboard when we spend time with patients. And, you know, it will hopefully let less patients fall through the cracks that way. Another interesting way it's been used, so we don't think of MRI brain as being terribly helpful in the diagnosis of ALS, but we know that that's a growing field as well. There was this virtual brain biopsy that's being done by one of the AI models in a study that we referenced, and it got sensitivity and specificity of up to 90% for the diagnosis of ALS by looking at the MRI of the brain. Of course, experts know we can look for things like the motor band sign and T2 flare, hyperintensity of the corticospinal tracts and all that stuff. But these models were getting that diagnosis using things that are yet to be determined. So a lot of the data we have, and including EMG, we throw away the baby with the bathwater. And what the AI tools are doing is making sure that doesn't happen in many ways.
One other thing you mentioned here is brain-computer interface. And so we probably all have ALS patients in our practice, and that's a huge thing. So that, I guess, is a little more self-explanatory maybe, but you can see how there's all kinds of applications there. But then also you mentioned a little bit with research in terms of assisting with research. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Sure. I'll touch on a couple of those very important points. So brain-computer interface, so BCI using deep learning in ALS patients. This is basically where you take these brain signals through scalp EEG, and they're very noisy signals, and it gets processed and transferred to external devices to allow movement. And with the DL models, they've been able to increase that accuracy up to 98%. So that's tremendous for robotics, or what we call embodied AI applications. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are a number of other applications for AI we mentioned in the paper. So I'll refer the reader to it, like, you know, using it to differentiate did between FSHD and myositis on MRI, Surface, EMG for ALS, personalized genetics and drug development and clinical trial efficacy. Your point about augmented intelligence, I think, is super important. So I see augmented intelligence as HI plus AI. So HI being human intelligence plus AI is equal to more than the total of its parts. So that is synergy. That's more than an additive benefit. You know, AI is to be supportive, is to play a supportive role to enhance human intelligence rather than replace it. And I think I can't say that frequently or loudly enough. AI will not replace human experts, but there is a higher chance of human experts who leverage AI replacing those that do not. And I think that's what we need to keep in mind. A human clinician's irreplaceable experiential knowledge plus AI algorithmic rigor and accuracy and efficiency is the winning combination that we're going for here.
And that's a great point. There are limitations, and I think the combined use is wonderful. Speaking of limitations, though, that's a good segue to some of the later parts of the paper. And so safeguards, regulation, Dr. Morin, you have proposed establishing this task force. Does the task force exist already, or is that an establishment now?
We do have an AANEM subcommittee. It's under the professional practice committee that's addressing this. But I do want Dr. Taha to speak a little bit about some of those important limitations that you mentioned, because I think people may ask, you know, are AI algorithms reliable? Are these findings generalizable? And those are very important questions. And I think it will kind of dovetail nicely into why we need to have some proper regulatory efforts.
Yeah, so for the limitation of AI, so in neuromuscular, it's still too early for the prime time, and we are definitely looking forward for more collaboration and getting more data. Specifically, when we talk about AI reliability, the term reliability here depends on whether this is the internal validity and reliability versus external validity. So the majority of the AI models developed in the neuromuscular field use small data. Those data could have a large of underrepresentation, some bias and stuff like that, and also does not reflect the disease diversity and the setting diversity that we see in our clinical practice. So we will have to cautious about using any of those models, and unless we get more big data that is representative to what we see. The second thing is the generalizability. This is the term used when you want to use an AI in a new settings that has not been used before. An example for that, let's say an AI was developed for an X EMG machine and performed highly. There is a chance when you deploy this model for other types of EMG machines or other settings, that performance might not hold anymore. And the difference is because the difference of data and sampling frequency and how the human themselves can sample the EMG signals and so on and so forth. So all of those issues boil down to availability of gold standard curated EMG data. And this also calls for the necessity for collaboration across institutions, gathering data from medical records, EMG signals and EMG reports, and developing a joint kind of project to help pushing forward the AI in the field of neuromuscular medicine so we can get the benefit of it and reduce the limitations.
And so this collaboration aspect is hugely important. And Dr. Morin, do you want to take it from there?
You know, I was going to say hugely important. And, you know, when you talk about research, you know, we could talk about how AI is helping research in the fields of neuromuscular enteral diagnostics with recruitments, simulated trials, remote monitoring for promising drugs. Certainly when it comes to advancing the field of AI itself, we do need consortia. We need collaboration across all these different institution settings and things to get truly diverse data so that we can ensure that our findings become widely applicable and generalizable. So, and we have efforts doing that in our own experience. We've been able to really branch out and collaborate with a lot of other colleagues, and not only in the United States, but internationally. And that's what we need. When it comes to your question about regulation and the work that AI task force can do, I could show you one fruit of that, because I mentioned the AANEM subcommittee on AI. We've been able to just put out our position statement. It's entitled The Role of AI in Neuromuscular and Electrodiagnostic Medicine. It will come out in an issue of Muscle and Nerve pretty soon, but it's actually available on the AANEM website. So I encourage our listeners to go to that, it really says a lot. But it's showing that as an organization, we're not burying our heads in the sand. This is not a genie you could put back into the bottle. People talk about different levels of AI acceptance, going from defensiveness to avoidance, and then finally acceptance and integration. And I do believe as members of this community, we need to get to the acceptance and integration phase of it. The pace of progress and the appropriate regulations are mismatched a little bit. We need proper guardrails, and nobody wants unnecessary regulations. That's true. Nobody wants bureaucracy. That's true. But if we do not place ourselves around the table, decisions will be made for us and not necessarily in the best interest of patients and providers.
That's very well put. A great sort of conclusion to the talk today. A lot of great things came out of this. I've learned a lot, and there's still more. So I would really encourage the listeners to check out that review article that was published recently in Muscle and Nerve for more details. Doctors Taha and Morin, once again, thanks to you both for this great article and for your time today.